Welcome to Transformative Talk, Critical Conversations for Teachers. I'm Dr. Zid Haddad, a professor of instruction within the Department of Interdisciplinary Learning and Teaching at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I teach undergraduate and graduate courses in curriculum and instruction. In short, I teach teachers how to teach and save lives through the use of critical multicultural education as an approach to teaching and learning. Our podcast is produced by a different group of graduate students each week, giving them an opportunity to talk about what they're reading in my class, what they experience in the field, and how that impacts their own lives and understandings. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast from wherever you're listening. Also, you can ask us questions and engage with us further using the anchor.fm website or the anchor.fm app on your phone. You can submit questions and you can also send us voice messages. And remember, please share our podcast on all your socials so that we can build our audience. Thanks for listening, and here's today's episode.
Changes made right here on Nursery Hill. You set this chicken your last time, 'cause now I've got the pill. Welcome, welcome to the latest episode of Transformative Talk. I am Kristen Henry. I'm joined by Nuthu Paul and Anne Pham. And if you hadn't guessed by the song we're playing, we're going to be talking about feminism today. And we wanted to start with a song from our playlist. We created a playlist and we wanted to start with The Pill by Loretta Lynn, kind of to honor her legacy. Since the week of this recording, she passed away. She was a trailblazer for women in country music, which is a very male-dominated genre. And still is. There's still a lot of talk about why women in country music are not played as much on the radio as their male counterparts. So you can imagine for back in the day when she sung that song, which was really all about bodily autonomy, that she was ahead of her time. So we, right, talking about feminism from kind of that time period and before to the now, we thought we would start with our, since we're all women, we're all feminists, we are all feminists trying to live in a patriarchy, y'all. So we thought one of the most appropriate ways to get started was to talk about our own experiences with the patriarchy, sexism, feminism, feminist theory. And then we're gonna kind of get and dive a little bit deeper. So Nuthu, do you wanna get us started? Talk a little bit about your personal journey with that.
So one of the earliest memories that I have living with my father is I would always get the statement, "You can't do this because you're a girl." And that was, I mean, it was just like a continuous running phrase. Even now, even when I go back home, I'm just like, "Oh, can I go out?" He's like, "No, you can't. Like, you're a girl. Girls should not be out past like when the sun sets." And he would essentially just kind of give up like the idea that, oh, if I was a guy, I would be able to do it. And so it was a whole bunch of like little things like that, like, oh, I can't be wearing like skin tight clothing, or I can't be wearing a lot of makeup, or, you know, I can't be like, well, that leads me into my next point, and that they're like, if you dress too girly and someone tries to talk to you or harass you, you're kind of asking for it. And so we've had lots of conversations like that. So my parents are always like, you should know better. Like, as a woman, like, you're supposed to have, like, you're supposed to hold yourself up to like a higher ideal, kind of. But I'm just like, how is that fair when guys are literally walking around doing whatever they want, coming back home whenever they want? But the moment I start doing it, it's a problem. So I was wondering if you guys have any similar experiences that, like, oh, you can't do that because you're a girl.
Anne, would you like to share?
Yeah, my story is similar with Nuthu as well. Yeah, growing up in the family, traditional family, I have been taught how to be feminine and realize the role and also responsibility have to be a girl, a woman in this house, and also a wife as well. So I had to learn a lot of things in the house, like cooking and everything. And the reason behind that, just for in the prepare for me in the future, I have my whole my old family and also live with the parents-in-law example. So I need to know those things. I didn't react so strongly when I heard about that, but inside me, I always have a thought like it's unfair. why the girl had to do the whole thing and why not men? Men also need support, girls also as well. And the other thing is that when I come into the US, I just started graduate school. There are many comments in my family about that because they have an opinion that girls shouldn't study too much, shouldn't have a higher degree a lot because it's really hard to get married. So that's the kind of thing that, and I thought that it was, at first I thought it was just my family. But then when I went to study abroad already, and another girl in my country, she also contacted me, asked me about, do you think it's a good idea to study a PhD program because we are women, so we need to have a family first and then get into the PhD program, or what do we need to do? So that's the thing that about the girls have to consider a lot about their sacrifice, a lot about their career, for example, and also about their freedom, their roles as well.
Absolutely. I would say I had, it's similar, but I think it was said differently, right? I was the little girl who was called bossy all the time, right? Oh, you're bossy. And then as I got older, you're just intimidating. Like, you're just intimidating. And so I had these like messages that me being like a leader and assertive were negative words, right? Like bossy and intimidating are not generally considered super positive, especially if you happen to be a woman. And if that really, I think when I was younger, I thought about, oh, well, I thought about how I should change. I think when I was younger, before I realized, oh, they're saying that because I'm female and I'm not supposed to be as outgoing or loud or vocal or bossy or whatever, right? They call the man the boss. They call women bossy. Kind of that language. I don't think I realized when I was younger, like the connotations with the word bossy. And so I kind of grew up trying to be myself, but having all these messages that what I was doing maybe wasn't what a girl does, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, now being a woman of a certain age who is not married, right, who decided to start her own business, buy her own house, do her own thing, it's still kind of like I don't always fit in with everyone because everyone's like married with kids, and I didn't do that traditional sort of that traditional path, which means that a lot of my friends are like me too. They're women with businesses, own their own house, things like that. And there's still that kind of pressure of, oh, are you ever going to get married? Are you ever? I mean, that's still like ever present. And, you know, I always wonder if men that are single at a certain age get that the same as women. It's something that I think about. Because I don't think they do. They're just like, oh, he's a bachelor, right?
Right, yeah.
He's focusing on his career. And, it's, you know, with women, it's like, maybe you know, focus less on your career. Maybe you need more time for, and that's what I get. Like, you know, Kristen, maybe you would be married if you had given.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, all the messages that we as women and get to be something that we aren't necessarily, right?
I have a story to add on to that. My dad's always talking to me about like marriage, but like in my country, they do more of like arranged marriages. And I just know the men that my father likes, I will never look twice at them. They're just not my type. And like, he's always like, he like looks down upon dating. Like there's like no dating in the house, but I mean, obviously I'm a little bit more rebellious. So I do it anyways. And he's just like, if you want to date so badly, like, I'm just gonna like get you married off to like some random man. And I'm just like, father, that's not how it works. We're in the 21st century now, you know, we're living in America, you know, I have the right to say no. But they just like, they see marriage as some type of like, I don't know, some holy thing that they put up on a pedestal. They're like, if you're a woman, like you have to be married. And I'm just like, what if I just want to live out my life for a couple of years? Why do I need to be like bound down to a man? And my mom's always like, you're living in a society. And in a society, women have to be married. They have to have kids. And I'm just like, I don't want to have kids right now. Like, I'm still a kid myself. I cannot imagine getting pregnant and raising a child at this day and age, I couldn't be able to do it. And they're just like, they just keep on saying it every single week I go home. They're just like talking about marriage. And I'm just like, mother, I'm still 23. Like, let me live out my life. I don't know. They just like,
yeah.
I don't know how to describe it. It's like, I don't know. They're like so fixated upon the idea that a woman has to be married. Like, if you're not married, then you're not going to be considered like successful or whatever.
I think for a lot of people, they see that when women are married, they're safe, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, well, if you're married, you're taken care of. If you're married, we don't have to worry about you anymore. Because
literally,
that has kind of been like years ago when women didn't work, right? If they didn't get married, like, who's going to take care of them, right?
Right.
There were those sort of messages. And so I think that's still there, even though that's not, right?
Women, it is. It's all about living in the patriarchy, because they're just like, they're like, yeah. Oh, you're not married. Oh, you're like your father's responsibility. And when you're married, now you're your husband's responsibility.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's just because we're looking at the social construction right now. So like you said, Nitsu, like, oh, you look at them in the society, women, that they marry, so you have to marry. Without any critical thinking about, do you ready for that? Are you ready for that? Or thinking about, do you really want that? Or are you prepared for everything for that? Those kind of things in the future. So it goes back to what we read in the in Crenshaw, talking about the liberatory objective should be implicit categories of any social significance. Yet, implicit in certain strands of feminist and racial liberation movements, for example, is the view that the social power in delineating difference need to not be the power of domination. It can instead be the source of social empowerment and reconstruction. So I think the key words here are social empowerment and reconstruction can be the key words kind of like transform the situation that it's not our, these stories, what we're telling right now is not only our stories. This can be the stories of many women out there. So the thing is that thinking about like, how could we give them the source of empowerment and how could we do the reconstruction of the society,
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that kind of brings us to kind of the history as I'm busily looking for the chapter we're about to talk about. And that kind of brings us to the history of the waves, right? Because we, even though we still have these messages, right, coming at us, are still beneficiaries of three waves of feminism, right? We're still, you know, benefiting from the first, second, and third wave. And before we start talking about the first, second, and third wave, I think it is important to mention that it didn't, right? It's not like during the first wave of feminism, it wasn't like the first time women ever tried,
right.
You know, to assert power. There were women leaders, queens, monarchs, probably, you know, just leaders in all different cultures. Mm-hmm. Or women who went, you know, against the grain. I think we were talking about like Joan of Arc. There have been women doing that. I would guess. It would be my guess since the beginning of there being women. So women have always been, you know, trying to assert themselves as people, right? As full people. But that brings us to the first wave of feminism that is really associated with suffrage, right? The right to vote. So let's talk a little bit, what do we think like that effect, how did that kind of get the ball rolling?
I think because the first wave kind of started talking about like, are the fundamental rights that I feel like women should have, with like the right to vote, you know, like rights that were kind of denied to them like through marriage beforehand, like access to healthcare and stuff like that. I think it kind of set the foundation, because like if you're able to vote, you know, you can implement more change. You know, access to healthcare, like what are they saying? Oh yeah, reproductive and sexual healthcare, like that's something that was like always frowned upon, always kind of, you know, like pushed under a rug just because it was for women. Like, oh, it was like, oh, we would have to close, like, if men were like able to get pregnant or whatever, like the right to abortion or whatever would be like a sacrament or something like that. So that's what money. I think it's at a good foundation.
Right. Because you know, think about it. If you don't have the right to vote, are you a full citizen in your country?
Right.
Yeah. It's a part of power as well. If you have the right to vote. In my country, yes, we also have right to vote. But as how the social construct, most of women, they don't care most, care much about the right to vote.
So
they can, but they don't refer that because a social construction, you know, they are just a woman, they just should be in the house, and they shouldn't vote in those public politics, something like that way. So I think, okay, we have the right there, but we need some action, or we need some advocates to raise their awareness about the rights as well, not just we give them the right and they don't do that. So that's why the issues still be there, because they don't have an action.
When did women in Vietnam get the right to vote? Do you know about what time when that was?
I think it's a long time ago, like maybe 1980s or 1990s.
Okay, so after in the United States,
after the Vietnam War.
Okay, so more recent comparatively, like within my lifetime, maybe not yours, within my lifetime, right? But I think there's also a lot of women that don't vote here. And you'll also hear women tangentially say they're just going to vote how their husband votes. Like, so it's like, you have a vote, but are you voting like the way, like we have the vote, but do we use it?
My mom's the same way. Like she's only voted if I like physically drag her to like the voting booth or whatever. And she's just like, it doesn't really matter like what her vote is. Like that's like her opinion on it.
I will say my mom and dad are always big voters. They vote very differently than I, but I've been dragged. Like I was sick one day, like this is pre-COVID where you went places sick. They're like, no, you must go vote. Right. So I was always taught to vote, which is why I'm like, I vote religiously. But that isn't the case, right? We have a really low voter turnout, like especially in Texas. It's like really low. So yeah, I think, you know, it's the same sort of thing, is that we have a right, but we don't use it.
Yeah.
I think we don't see the importance of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or we've been convinced that it doesn't matter, right? I think that happens a little bit too.
Yeah, maybe Whitley is already managed. So our voice doesn't matter.
Yeah. I think there's rhetoric out there that says that. I really believe we do have a voice. Okay, so that was first wave, right? Getting the vote, and now we're looking like, do we use it? we fought so hard, and then...
Right.
So then we get to second wave, right? Which was mostly... white housewives wanting to be more out in the world, right?
Yeah, when they were like obtaining rights only for like middle class white women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm.
There was a quote in the second wave like, of that chapter. It was like, a woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle.
Oh,
like, that cracked me up.
Yes, and I'll find it, because it said it's from Gloria Steinem, but it's not, and it's in her book. Like, who actually said it?
Yeah,
but again, most women were housewives, they raise the children. If they might have worked before, but once they get married, they didn't. Like my mom, when she got married, well, she worked for my dad, but you know, she didn't go back to her other job. I, for some reason, whenever I think of like second wave feminism, I think of the show Mad Men, and like Peggy, you know, like women in career. Does anyone else just think about Mad Men? I mean, like, the lonely housewife at home, and you know, the women in the office who their housewives are like, what are you doing? And they're literally trying to have a career, but there's all sorts of shenanigans. And I think that's more where we get the whole idea of desperate housewives is from that era than from others.
But I was like wondering, the second wave started in like the 1960s for like middle class white women. I'm just like, what time period do you think it started for like people of color and like minorities and stuff like that? Because like I feel like we didn't get a lot of minorities until like the 80s and 90s and stuff like that.
It depends. I don't know. Like Gloria, when I was watching Gloria Steinem, she always had an African American woman that spoke with her. She named them, and the second one was Dorothy. Dorothy's the one, the famous shot of both of them at their fists of the air.
Oh yeah.
And they would speak together to, you know, crowds of both black and white women. So I think it was in places. I just don't know that it was the dominant. I don't know if it was the dominant. I mean, it wasn't the dominant force of feminism, but I think it was around, right?
Would you want to go back to that time period?
everyone talks about the good old days. I was like, the good old days for who?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't until like the 1970s women could have their own like credit card in their name.
Yeah.
Which blows my, and that happened during the second wave. Women started to be able to work more, have more things in their name. Get benefits. I think about, if you've ever like watched the documentary about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and all, you know, the amount of times that she spoke at the Supreme Court to get rights for both men and women, that you now were like, duh, now seems so obvious, but that was happening in the 70s, in the 70s, and thinking about things that, you know, people didn't have a right to do, or been like a man's wife was in like the military and she died, but because he was a man, he couldn't get her benefits, even though he was taking care of their children. I mean, all sorts of things that now you just, it goes both ways with spouses, and it didn't before. So just really interesting, the little things that, again, we take for granted. I mean, maybe I don't want my credit card debt, but I want to be able to have it.
So what we mentioned, that the women, they have a, in the second wave, women started to work. So have you ever think back about, is it a good idea for women to go to work? However, sometimes I also think that it's like a double pressure on them, especially in my country. Yes, women got to work, and then they have to wake up every single morning at earlier, like 5 o'clock, to do some housework first, and then go to work. And afterwards, they have to take care for their kids and cooking and everything. And especially at weekends, they have to take time on weekends to do housework, to do chores, instead of like enjoying life. So I wonder, is it a good movement for the women to have a freedom to go to work? Or is at the same time, it also like adding more burden on them to take care of the family and also the work as well?
Well, I mean, the problem was they took on more responsibility outside of the house, but they're still doing the same amount, maybe not the same amount inside the house, but they're still doing the majority of the work inside the house. And I think, there's a quote somewhere, I need to find it. It's like, women won't be equal until they have equal work inside the house.
Literally, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think someone had asked me, they're like, what's your dream job? And I was like, I don't dream of working. I don't dream of working ever. So I'm like, I don't know if it is a good thing, because we do have that added responsibility. And like, it's usually like, it falls upon like the mom or whatever to like take care of the kids, do all the cooking, do all the cleaning, while, you know, the husband just goes to work and comes back and expects a plate ready at the table. So I'm just like, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think it's all about the choice. But I think we still have to, you know, like get society to move to, where it's not expected that women still do everything at the house, right? You know, it's like a friend of mine, she felt weird for a while because she was working and her husband was staying home. He was a stay-at-home dad. versus her. And it was kind of hard for her because, I mean, she was making the money for the family, and she also felt like her daughter didn't know her as well. Because dad was home, right?
Yeah.
So, and it was perfect because he was having a rough job at the time and he wanted to leave his work anyway, and they didn't want their daughter to be in daycare. But, you know, and she kind of was like, you know what? No, I'm a modern woman. And that's, you know, that's how it's going to be. So I should embrace the fact that he's doing all these things. I should be grateful that he does the groceries and the laundry and all of the stuff as a stay-at-home dad. And I think it's becoming more acceptable for men to stay home if the wives make more money. I don't think it was. And I think some people probably still look at it in an odd way. But I also think it's hard sometimes for women who are like, but I wanted to spend more time with my child.
Yeah.
And I think really it's about women be able to have that choice. Like, do I want to work? Do I want to stay home? Do I want my husband to be the stay-at-home parent? Mm-hmm. And it's about having that choice to do that. And some women have made it work. And I think some women it's a struggle because they're still doing everything. They're full-time job, full-time mom, full-time everything. So the struggle, I think, is still very real. And do we think any of that has changed a little bit so third wave comes in, right? It's more inclusive. That's where we kind of get into the intersectionality of looking at how, you know, gender and race intersect, and looking at the different kinds of sexism and how women who look differently experience sexism in different ways. And so we have this third wave that's more inclusive of all types of women. And I mean, do you think that's changing with third wave? I mean, how do we think the third wave is going, I guess, is the question.
I think the third wave was what we've needed, because I was like trying to read up on like the fourth wave, if there was one, but I'm just like, I feel like the third wave kind of, not like forced us, but it kind of allowed us to keep an open mind and like pursue that open mind and just be more like accepting and like, I don't know, I feel like it kind of made us into more empathetic people.
Well, to be able to look at different perspectives from maybe not everybody experiences life this way. For sure. And I mean, we'll talk about probably, I guess, after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about like the Kim Crenshaw article and intersectionality, because I feel like that's a whole section. But do we, because you mentioned fourth wave, do we see a fourth wave? The need, do we see it? Do we see a need for it? Like,
I think these waves, they kind of overlapping together. And now the fourth way, maybe we're thinking about the queer for the rights of queer people or disabled people, because those waves, they didn't mention about disabled people, disabled women or queer, you know. So I think now maybe the next movement, they need to talk more about that. To empower them or to think about. And also I think that the important thing in feminism, I think that they need to think about the men roles as well. That's the kind of thing that me thinking about the word, maybe the feminism make them thinking about this is just because it comes from the feminine. So the men, they think, oh, that's on the women's right. But in fact, deep down to the rabbit hole, it's also had the men's right there as well. So I think in the next wave, maybe they should mention about that so we can kind of have like more nuanced understanding about feminism.
Yeah, you know, it was really interesting. When we were talking about bodily autonomy, or we were doing our activity in class and we put bodily autonomy and someone put that it didn't apply to them, right? They were men. And I was really thinking about that. And I'm like, how does bodily autonomy not apply to a man? Like, you have a body, you want control of it, you want to make decisions about your body. Don't, I mean, I would think men would want bodily autonomy. The fact that it's seen as like only
as
really
a woman
like,
thing, yeah.
As mm-hmm. like it's associated with like birth control and abortion rights mm-hmm. and all these things. But you know, I think about right all the protests in Russia because men don't want to go to war, right? They don't want their body to be used mm-hmm. as a weapon of war. Is that not bodily autonomy?
It literally is, yeah. Like you want control of your own body, like you want the right to be able to say no. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just like, yeah, if you have a body and you would like control over it, you want bodily autonomy. I don't see how, you know, and when I was listening to Gloria Steinem, she said that bodily autonomy before both men and women is the fundament of democracy, right? That's the mm-hmm. core of democracy is that mm-hmm. everyone, regardless of sex, gender, whatever, has bodily autonomy. And so I'm like, you know, maybe we need to talk about it in a way where people go, it's not just about women's rights, it's about human rights. Mm-hmm. Because there's, I mean, if you think about, you know, we're talking about, you know, what might change with a fourth wave and like the inclusion of like trans women into feminism. But like the right to be able to have gender affirming surgery, which is a right under fire in a lot of states, right? That's also bodily autonomy. Mm-hmm. So I think they've made like bodily autonomy one little thing, at least in the media, right? But bodily autonomy is big and very all encompassing, I think.
I think it's just like, it just goes under like a Venn diagram. They're like, oh, bodily autonomy, abortion, like all of that is just classified under women and men just, they have like they don't need to worry about those things kind of because it's like already given to them,
right? Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's given to like straight men anyway.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
I would consider if you get to have sex with who you want to have sex with and your state says no, then that's also a bodily autonomy issue, right? So there's a small group of people that don't see it as an issue, but I'm pretty sure during the draft for the Vietnam War, when they were being sent over to another country when they didn't want to, mm-hmm. they would have said like, hey, I don't want to go. And a lot of men did say they didn't want to go.
Right.
I would think that's a bodily autonomy issue.
With the fourth wave, I was like trying to like map it out in my head. I'm like, so the third wave was kind of like in the late 80s and 90s. And then it's supposed to be like up to present day, but in my head, I'm just like, I feel like the third wave kind of stopped in like the early 2000s. And like the fourth wave was more of like the online social media part. Cause like in the past like decade or so, we had a lot of like the hashtag Me Too movement. And, you know, we had a lot more like activists online compared to like back then. So that's why like, I mapped that in my head. I was like, oh, fourth wave is probably like more online.
So are you saying that's like fourth wave and not third wave, like part two?
I think so because I feel like the online community is like, though, that's a whole different like conversation. Like you have so many different platforms, so many different activists, and you know, like so many things that just trend and like go viral within like weeks and then people never talk about it again.
That's true. All right, anything else we want to say about these waves before we kind of dive into our different sections of reading, because I'm kind of curious to hear about your sections that you read, because I didn't, right? We didn't read each other. So I'm like kind of excited to hear about some of the highlights of the Bailey and Cuomo reading. So are we ready? Are we ready to jump into those? Just talk about some of the highlights, some of the things we found interesting. Let's see, who had chapter 3? Anne, was that you? Did you have chapter 3?
Yeah, in chapter 3, they're talking about the sex and gender. So one of the things that they mentioned about biological femaleness is considered a category of sex and femininity. What it means to be a normal or proper female in a particular context, so it's a category of gender as well. So I think nowadays we kind of already have, like, I'm sorry, I lost my mind a little bit. I think like female we need to like, it's similar like redefining gender about female, male, and also the also the third gender that we're talking about as well. And I think they also talking about the second sex, which is to catch my thoughts a lot about this. That one of them, the quote in that they mentioned about human beings. In actuality, the relation of two sexes is not quite like that, but two electrical poles. For men represents both the positive and the neutral, as is indicated by common use of men to designate human beings in general, whereas women represent for only the negative defined by limited criteria without reciprocity. It's similar with, like, for example, we're telling about a story in my country that they mentioned about the breath. So in the fire, you know, in the karaoke one, they have a fire. And then one of the women, they use the breath to cover her nose to escape from the fire. And in the media, all those things, they pour it to her, like, is it an appropriate one to use the breath to cover your nose? So, but in that case, your life is more important than thinking about what, why, you know. And then, and recently, just last week, I read an article, they're talking about one of the dissertation of the PhD program, a PhD doctoral student. They mentioned about breath in their dissertation, and it is not appropriate. And they have some arguments about that. I mean, we are human beings are more important than judging those kind of things. So I think that's why in the class, Dr. Haddad just mentioned about, like, should we change the feminism to the humanization, and another word, you know?
Yeah. Problem is, humanism, like, that term already means things to me, right? But yeah, it's absolutely, absolutely true. Absolutely. So interesting. Good food for thought for our listeners to be thinking. All right. Anithi, you had the next one, correct?
I do. This section was very interesting. Talking about a woman's sexuality. And so the first question that I'm going to ask you guys is, do you think a woman is denied of her sexuality?
In society, yes, I think so. To fully embrace it anyway, yes, I would say yes.
There was like a couple of quotes from the very first section. It was titled like "The Sex Which Is Not One." Okay, so I'm gonna read this quote. So it says, "For the clitoris is conceived as a little penis pleasant to masturbate so long as castration anxiety does not exist. And the vagina is valued for the lodging it offers the male organ when the forbidden hand has to find a replacement for pleasure giving." So that was kind of like the main theme throughout that first section. And I was like, you know, I never thought about it like that. Like they were just talking about how like the vagina serves also, but not only to take over the little boy's hand in order to like assure an articulation between autoeroticism and heteroeroticism and intercourse. And I was just like, that was mind blowing for me. I was like, to me, it kind of sounded like they were placing the vagina as like secondary to the penis. Like it was kind of like that was like its main core, like its main purpose essentially. And then in the second section, a couple of quotes that I pulled out was like, oh, do women lose their sexuality like after they enter motherhood?
I think that's a question that probably none of us have children, but I would bet that a lot of women after they do wonder if they're still seen in that way. Mm-hmm. Right? Or are they now just completely seen as like the mother and not the lover, I guess?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And a quote that I had highlighted from that section, it was like after motherhood, the mother is no longer culturally articulated as like a sexual object. You know, one that desires something for herself. And then, you know, once sexuality is like cut from reproduction, and then a woman is no longer a mother, then they're at a loss of an image of like about a woman's like sexual agency. So those were a couple of interesting things that I pulled out. It's a really good reads though. They're like pretty short essays. And they have a lot of powerful moving quotes in there, just really talking about like not just feminism, just like a woman's sexuality, like what is a woman's desire? Like, are we denied of it? Like how does it progress on throughout adulthood?
Yeah. And I guess I would relate that a little bit to our reading of Audre Lorde and her writing about erotica, even though it sounds like they were much more graphic in the essays we were reading.
A little bit more, yeah. Awesome. But they still said the same message.
Awesome. Very interesting. And I think that's important. I think, you know, when we were talking about why certain songs that are like explicit, but about female sexuality, people are like, oh, we can't listen to that, but they'll listen to one about male sexuality. I think that kind of comes to that, like what's appropriate for men and women. And it's clearly a little bit different. So I had this section on race. And one of the articles in that section, probably the biggest part of that section, we're going to talk about after the break because it's the Crenshaw piece. But a lot of it was about Indigenous women in both the United States and Australia having very different ideas, right, than the white woman. And so how was, you know, they were trying to be part of the feminist movement, second wave feminism, but like they weren't being heard. And it's kind of so that struggle of how do we as Indigenous women have rights too, while at the same time being Indigenous. So that kind of gets us to the intersectionality that we'll talk about after the break. The other one was the essay by Bailey talking about specifically like white women and what it meant to be like a race traitor. Like she talks about a couple who bought a house in a white neighborhood specifically to sell to a black couple. Mm-hmm. And of course they, you know, so they sold to the black couple and then everybody was mad at them. And so, yes, they used their privilege, right? They were privilege cognizant. They're aware of their privilege and they used it. And they were race traitors, right? They did something that you're not supposed to do, right? At that time as a white person. And so, but at the same time, they could still like move to a different city and they're just white people, right? Like they can like escape, like they can be labeled race traitors somewhere, but they can go somewhere else and no one's gonna know about that. So they don't carry the same, right? Just, you can be white and be a race traitor, but that isn't necessarily gonna follow you the way if you're black, that's, you know, that will follow you, right, in terms of mm-hmm. oppression, right? Mm-hmm. So she talks a little bit about that and about being privilege cognizant, like you're aware of your privilege, you know how to use it for good, or privilege evasive, where you don't want to admit your privilege, or you just kind of would like to just live life in ignorance and not mm-hmm. talk about it, right?
Yeah.
And then she talks to some women about the scripts that they, you know, were raised with as white women. And I kind of relate a little bit to that, like the things that people would say that you start to normalize. Mm-hmm. And then when you get older, you're like, oh, wait, right? Like, oh, we don't do that. Or we don't go there. Or we don't go to that neighborhood. You know, the things that you hear repetitively and that it takes a while as you get older to kind of break away and realize those scripts are problematic. And it was interesting. I keep going back to, you know, listening to Gloria Steinem speak, but it's Gloria Steinem. So, and she said, she feels like women get more radical as they get older because they're able to break away from those scripts and those notions that they were like raised into. And it takes a while to do that sometimes. And so I thought that was interesting because I felt like the women in the essay were essentially going, oh, yeah, I didn't realize that that was what I was being trained to do, or that was a script that made me act a certain way. Mm-hmm. So that was my section. Anything else we need to talk about in terms of these readings before we head to break?
I think we covered a good chunk of it. Mm-hmm. Gave the highlights of each section.
Yeah. So when we come back, we're going to talk about intersectionality. And we're going to go out with a little bit of, we're going to listen to a little Aretha Franklin, another legend, sisters doing it for themselves. We're going to take that to break. Oh, except that you can't hear it. There we go. All right. So welcome back to Transformative Talk. I'm Kristen Henry, joined by Ann Pham and Neethu Paul. We are listening, of course, to Beyonce, because who runs the world?
Girls.
Yeah. At least that's what we wish and hope for, right?
I think that's kind of like a one of like empowerment, social empowerment. You give the power to women right now today. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. I love listening to empowering music, which is probably why we decided to add it and why we made a playlist, because we're just three feminists living in the patriarchy. All right. So we had mentioned several times in the first section, intersectionality, which is a term that was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw. But I think you could see it in readings, like suggestions of it in earlier readings. But ladies, what was our big takeaway from a very, like, it was a longer read, but it was a really good read.
Yeah, what I'm taking away that one of the quotes I really like, that intersectionality rambly concerns the way things work rather than who people are. So it means that we need to make progress, we need to make action. So nowadays in education, as an educator and a researcher, or we need to advocate to raise the awareness, also help them make it into practice in school, in classrooms, to raise the awareness of kids about to give them the social empowerment, and also to let them know that they have voice, and especially for girls as well, to protect themselves as well. And our classmate did talk a lot about empowerment and reconstruction, social reconstruction. Like, for example, what one of our classmates did mention about, as an educator, empowering those not in dominant groups to advocate for themselves and find their voice, instead of using her power to show the differences between classes. So she also encourage those who feel marginalized to lift themselves up and push for equality. So I think that's really a good point to mention here, about talking about equality, talking about equity in education. This is a really, like, very, it's like an intersectional topic about to find equal and equality, and also equity for students nowadays. And and another quote I think in the articles of Coles and Crenshaw and their colleagues, they also mention about, and I see this quote repeat many in our classmate journals, that is, people are willing to think about many things. What people refuse to do or are not permitted to do or resist doing is to change the way they think. Yeah. So it's also that one I also have notes in my journal as well, because it's really hard to change the way who we are, it's hard to change the way who we think because we're growing up in that environment. It's already construct our thought about our ideas about the world already. It's really hard to change. But also a quote in the ratings articles, they also mentioned, but there's not a reason for it is there. Is it there for not reason? You know, so we need to change it. It's hard to change, it's hard to move, but we need to change it. We need to advocate, we need to do some process regarding into education from the social movements and, you know, and so on and beyond. So I think that's really a really good point.
And I think these readings are really about action, mm-hmm. and how do we really live intersectionality in our research and our education. And it does take a different perspective in order to do that, right?
I made a connection. I was like, this is about to sound really dumb if you guys haven't seen the movie or read the book, but have you seen the movie Divergent?
Yes.
Okay, great. So the whole talk about intersectionality, it reminded me of like factions that they had in Divergent. And you know how they were like categorized by like virtues and stuff like that. And then the main character ended up being Divergent. And I was like, like she fit into more than one thing. And I was like, is that not what intersectionality is all about? Or was I just like reaching for the stars there?
Maybe. I don't know. I hadn't thought about it. Like I've seen the movie Divergent, but now I'm thinking of like, is that a divergent? Not, I mean, is that an intersectional? I don't know. Now I'm gonna have to ponder that. That's a question for our listeners. Can you make a connection between the movie Divergent and intersectionality?
Yeah, because like I think at the very end of like the mapping your identity thing, I think she was like talking about like coalitions or something, and I was like, are coalitions not like factions? Like,
I was like coalition building.
Yeah.
I mean, she points out so many statistics in that article that are just like, man, right? I mean, the fact that if a man rapes a Black woman, he gets less time in jail than if he rapes a white woman. Like, just the whole value system of the legal system, right? And how it puts value on people. I thought, it's like, you know it. It's like, we know it exists, but when you see like facts like that, I think it really puts it into just really
perspective
of how screwed up it is, you know, and to Anne's point, like, how do we change that? Like, how do we take action? And I think, you know, Neethu had mentioned how social media and like Me Too and Time's Up and all of those took action to, you know, like get Harvey Weinstein finally like arrested and in jail, mm-hmm. And things like that. So, I mean, I guess social media could be a part of that action, but, you know, after doing the readings, like, what do we think action looks like for us?
Oh, I think about as an educator, as also about a researcher, we can mention that in our study, also especially in our research, to make it like into practice, into action, for have something, a little action into classroom. For example, I am familiar with kids, with pre-K, with elementary. So I'm thinking about, we can start to talk about their body protection early age. For example, kids to distinguish boys and girls, and also the other, also respect the other genders as well, if they know. And the other thing that about, like, they need to learn about their bodies is really important, and they need to learn about how to protect them even though they're young, but we need to raise awareness about that for them. Because in the past, education in my country, they don't mention that in the book as well. They don't mention that, well, they avoid that. But a lot of issue with rap, with domestic violence, something like that way, we need to put in there, because those are the social issues. We need to raise awareness from the younger age so they can learn how to protect themselves. And we can help to avoid, to reduce those issues like rape or domestic violence. So I think we just a little movement, we hopefully can make it bigger in the future. And it takes a lot of effort, time, and also communities. Also, you know, we need to do it together, not only by ourselves.
I think that's a good point. I feel like the topic of just sex itself is just seen as such a taboo topic, and like it's like shunned upon, like you're never supposed to speak about it. Like I know my parents never gave me the talk, like we don't even use like any type of like sexual terms, like anything like that. It's just like so frowned upon, and I'm just like, and there are a lot of kids that like they don't even know like what their body parts are called or anything like that. So I think that mm-hmm. is a very good start. It's like educating them about that, and like learning what consent is from an early age, mm-hmm. and just, you know, like, oh, do you want this person to hug you? Like just small things like that. Like, I don't know. I feel like we never got like talks like that when we were younger, and it probably affected us like how we were growing up because mm-hmm. we never got talks like that. So, but at the same time, I don't know how we would like bring up those topics in school. Cause like, we're obviously going to like face a lot of opposition, and not a lot of parents would want, you know, like their kids to be like educated on that at that early of an age. So I don't know. I feel like it's going to be really tough.
There's a lot yeah. of pushback with sex mm-hmm. education. Right. And you're like, Texas, it's like abstinence only, which the research shows that type doesn't work, right?
It doesn't like, work. Mm-hmm. I'm just like,
the upfront, like, yeah. education is what gets it. And of course, you know, it's not like our lawmakers are like, what's research based? They're like, what will get me voted into office? Mm-hmm. So yeah, and I mean, and I think really conversations about sexuality, especially for girls, because everyone just assumes that boys are going to be off and doing whatever, but mm-hmm. talking to girls about their sexuality, and so they understand like what's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think would, you know, go a long way in having young women like have better ownership of their body and know like what's going on. But yeah, to Neetha's point, I mean, right now, like all the stuff that's going on, you know, like in Florida, like the Don't Say Gay bill. And I mean, mm-hmm. like all of these things that it's, you know, it's becoming increasingly, how do we push back, right? How do we take action and push back? How are we intersectional when there's laws that say, oh no, don't talk about race, right? Don't talk about race. Don't talk about sexuality. Don't talk about like anything that we've talked about today.
So that's why what we read, that's kind of connected to what we read, what Shadid mentioned. It's really hard to move, really hard to move, but there is no reason they are there. You know, there's a reason they are there. So we need to touch it down, even though it's sensitive for us, but it needs to, especially for girls that we have taught, like, don't manipulate that, like, oh, don't close to boys, don't close to men, because, like, in my culture, in my country, there's a fun thing that some mom teach the girls, like, don't hold boys' hands because you can have pregnant. What? You need to teach them how to protect themselves, not by telling them the other, not you know, like manipulate another thing to bring it up, you know, like a liar to them, you know.
Well, so yeah, you're lying. And then when they get in a situation where they're doing something that can get them pregnant, no one's told them that.
Literally.
Yeah, because no one told them that. They just told her, you know, like, oh, holding hand. I didn't holding hand, but I'm still pregnant. That's what they said, for example. So we need to raise the awareness, not only kids, but also parents as well. I mean, like communities.
Cause like I know a whole bunch of like the older generation, like they see like a woman's virginity as like their sense of self-worth in a sense, uh-huh. and they're like, oh, if a woman loses her virginity, all of a sudden you're worthless, you're useless, whatever, like used or whatever. And I don't know, like I feel like when you're like in that generation, it's so hard to change their opinion because that's what they were like taught, that's what they grew up on for like several decades. And I feel like that's, I don't want to say it's a lost cause, but it's pretty much a lost cause. You can't really change their opinions.
Yeah, but it's really, it just puts the, it tells women that they're only worthy for certain things. And I think it's such a problem. It's so problematic. Right. That, if you tell a girl that, she's like, well, then all this other thing that I've done, all the greatness I do in the world. And yeah, that
doesn't matter. As long as if I don't have that, I guess I'm useless.
Like, yeah. I mean, it's all about, we know it's all about controlling women and women's bodies and all that stuff. But I think some people that say it don't realize like how it's so rooted in sexism. Right. Because women say it. And I was talking to someone the other day, and this is usually like a metaphor that you use when you talk about racism, when people are like, I'm not racist, but they've said something clearly racist.
Yeah.
And it's, I think it's Dr. Kendi, Dr. Ibram Kendi, who said it. He's like, it's like you're standing in the rain and you've been standing in the rain your whole life, but you don't realize that you're wet. Right. You don't. Like you don't realize like, oh, you have been in a racist, sexist system forever. You can't escape it. You're dripping wet. If you have to realize that, you have to realize you're standing in the rain. And so many people don't realize they're standing in the rain. And it's like, how do you get people to realize that? Like,
and dogs go in the grave wet because they never considered it.
Like, oh, ladies, this has been fun. Do we have any final thoughts, additional things we need to wrap up today? I mean, I'm sure we could talk for another hour, but I don't.
I mean, if anyone has any like commentary on our podcast, feel free.
Oh yeah, we would love we would love to know your ideas. We hoped we shared a little bit of ourselves, a little bit of the readings, a little bit of the world. And any final thoughts?
I think in conclusion, I think this topic is kind of really problematic, and also it's hard to move, but somehow hopefully we need to raise hope that we can have some a little change at least, and you know, and then to make some a little movement, and then make to have a better life, especially for girls, you know.
I love that. I love that we're ending on a hopeful note. Thank you for that. I like ending on a hopeful note. And we're also going to end after I sign off. I'm going to play a little of the Lindas, who are like the next generation of punk rock, and they are singing Racist Sexist Boy. So thank you all. That's all for the episode. Thank you for listening. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, leave a review, wherever you discover our show. That's all for now. Keep listening for our next episode. And here are the Lindas. Thank you.